Malcolm X.
No sellout.
Malcolm X.
No sellout.
Malcolm X.
No sellout.
Malcolm X.
No sellout.
White, black, brown, red, yellow. Doesn't make any difference what color you are. Is power. They take one little word out of what you say, ignore all the rest, and then begin to magnify it all over the world to make you look like what you actually are.
Much of what I say might sound like it's stirring up trouble, but it's the truth, 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 it's the truth. We don't care who likes it or not, as long as we know it's the truth.
Malcolm X.
No sellout.
Malcolm X.
No sellout.
Malcolm X.
No sellout.
Malcolm X.
No sellout. You can't deny that. You may not like my saying it, but you can't deny it. If you're afraid to tell the truth, why you don't even deserve freedom.
And as long as those ingredients, explosive ingredients, remain, then you're going to have the potential for explosion on your hands. Malcolm X.
No sellout.
Malcolm X.
No sellout.
Malcolm X.
No sellout.
Malcolm X.
No sellout.
But nothing is on it. Because all of us are sitting at the same table, are all of us diners? I'm not a diner until you let me dine. Then I become a diner. I was in a house last night that was bombed my own. It isn't something that made me lose confidence in what I'm doing. some enemies.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from the so-called Great White North here in Toronto, Canada. And we kick the show off with the music of Keith LeBlanc, and he used the voice of Malcolm X, El Haj Malik El Shabazz, and that piece was called No Sellout. And we're going to be featuring this first half hour is going to be Malcolm X music, and we're going to be playing music from Marion McCabe, Dennis Brown, and Archie Shepp, and Khalil El-Zabar. But we have a very action-packed show for you today. In a few moments, we're going to be speaking with Herb Boyd and Malcolm X's daughter, Ilyasha El Shabazz, and they're going to be speaking about the diary of Malcolm X, and that is going to come out on November the 10th, which is the 50th anniversary of Malcolm X's message to the grassroots speech, which he gave at King Solomon Baptist Church in Detroit, Michigan. And we're going to be speaking about that. We're going to have a tribute to Don Drummond, the great trombonist. And Don Drummond, there's a book out called Don Drummond, The Genius and the Tragedy of the World's Greatest Trombonist. And that was written by Heather Augustine. And the foreword is by Delfino Marcellus. That's one of the Marcellus brothers. And we're going to be having an interview with Miss Jody, who is an echo recording artist, and she's out of Mississippi. We're going to be speaking with her in the last half an hour. And there's a big controversy in Toronto, Canada, with the mayor. The mayor is on the hot seat. He was filmed. There were pictures of him in the papers about 5 months ago, where he was supposedly caught smoking crack cocaine with a group of black youth, and the police have recovered the videos, so they say, and Mr. Ford is on the hot seat, and I could say that as Teddy Pendergrass would say, the whole town's laughing at me. They're laughing at him, and also the mayor has a radio show in Toronto, and he has his brother on, Doug Ford, and his brother comes on like Flavor Flav with Public Enemy. He's like, yeah, boy, whatever his brother says. It's a very tragic situation. He's real. Rob Ford is a real, comes across as a real buffoon. We'll keep you updated as to what is going to take place with the mayor of Toronto. He says he's not going anywhere. He's going to actually going to run for re-election on January the in January of 2014. But let us continue with the music of Marion McCabe as she pays tribute to El Haj Malik El Shabazz, Malcolm X.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Our next song was written for us by my little girl, who's not so little anymore. She's named Bongi. She wrote the song about a great man. I say a great man because it was a black man who fought for liberation, for the liberation of black people. Ladies and gentlemen, Malcolm X. Everybody seems to be preaching revolution, though no one ever seems to show appreciation to that man over there who brought about a new generation.
during slavery, when black people like me talked to the slaves, they didn't kill them. They'd send some old house Negro along behind him to undo what he said. You have to read the history of slavery to understand this. There were two kinds of Negroes. There was that old house Negro and the field Negro. And the house Negro always looked out for his master. When the field Negroes got too much out of line, he held them back in check. He put them back on the plantation. The house Negro could afford to do that because he lived better than the field Negro. He ate better, he dressed better, and he lived in a better house. He lived right up next to his master in the attic or the basement. He ate the same food his master ate and wore his same clothes. And he could talk just like his master, good diction. And he loved his master more than his master loved himself. That's why he didn't want his master hurt. If the master got sick, he'd say, "What's the matter, boss? We sick?" When the master's house caught a fire, he'd try and put the fire out. He didn't want his master's house burned. He never wanted his master's property threatened. And he was more defensive of it than the master was. That was the house Negro. But then you had some field Negroes who lived in huts, had nothing to lose. They wore the worst kind of clothes, they ate the worst food, and they caught hell. They felt the sting of the lash. They hated their master. Oh, yes, they did. If the master got sick, they prayed that the master died. If the master's house caught a fire, they prayed for a strong wind to come along. This was the difference between the two. And today you still have house Negroes and field Negroes. Yeah. I'm a field Negro. All men live in unity.
Nanga Def, for all of you people out there who speak Wolof, and people in West Africa and Senegal and in Gambia and in the diaspora. We're listening to the voice of Dennis Brown, who did a piece called Malcolm X. Dennis Brown, the Crown Prince of Reggae. I think he was crowned by Bob Marley, but that's Dennis Brown doing paying tribute to El Hajj Malik El Shabazz. We also heard from El Hajj Malik El Shabazz himself. He was speaking at the King Solomon Baptist Church in Detroit. He talked about the house Negro and the field Negro. And we kicked that set off with Marion McCabe. She did her tribute to El Hajj Malik El Shabazz. And I would like to thank two people, Omali Ishatella, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party, for giving me the spot on diasporic music. And I also would like to thank Archie Shep, who gave me the concept of diasporic music. And we're getting ready to listen to some music from Archie Shep in a few seconds. But if you have any, if you want to email us, you can check us by going to DJ at Uhuru Radio. The Skype option is just Uhuru Radio. And the North American telephone number, the North American telephone number, I assume that is Mexico as well as the United States and Canada. I haven't got any clarity on that. But if you are from Mexico, we would really like to hear from you. And that number is 727-565-1599. 727-565-1599. And if you are in the Dish United Kingdom, you can call us at 020-8133-6629. And right now we're going to listen to some music from one of my mentors, Brother Archie Shep, and he's joined here by Khalil El-Zabar. Khalil El-Zabar is a ritual trio, and they're doing a piece called Brother Malcolm.
Brother Malcolm, 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 Brother Malcolm. Brother Malcolm, Brother Malcolm, Brother Malcolm, Brother Malcolm, Brother Malcolm. Thank you.
The Uhuru Movement invites you to the 6th Congress of the African People's Socialist Party, December 7th through 11th. 5 days, 3 locations, all in and around St. Petersburg, Florida. This is your chance to hear speakers from around the world, enjoy lectures, a grand banquet, and silent auction with African gifts from many countries. The African People's Socialist Party sprang to life in 1972 in an era of struggle for black power, for justice, and for self-determination. That struggle continues today and is even more urgent. Come and be a part of the largest gathering of freedom-loving African peoples and our allies. Turmoil and crisis reign across the globe. The system we were taught to believe in does not serve us. Colonized peoples on every continent are rising up to reclaim what is ours. The African People's Socialist Party is building a massive organization to unify African people worldwide. The goal being to regain control over the riches of Africa and the wealth that our labor has created. Here in America, where are we safe? In the gated communities? In the hood? In schools? For African people who thought we could make a future for our children inside the system, it's 50 years later, and Malcolm X's words ring truer than ever. The American dream, for us, is an American nightmare. Make plans now to join us for the 6th Congress of the African People's Socialist Party, December 7th through the 11th. 5 days, 3 locations, all in and around St. Petersburg, Florida. For more information, visit APSPUHURU.org. That's APSPUHURU.org. Or call 727-821-6620. That's 727-821-6620. This is your chance to learn more about you. Uhuru. Information, ideas, reality. That's what the Burning Spear newspaper offers you each month. Truth about government, society, entertainment, and the world around you. The Burning Spear is the oldest Black Power newspaper in existence, and your one-year subscription is only $25. Get the insight and perspective that the mass media machine cannot and will not deliver. Read dynamic articles on the most pressing issues affecting the lives of African workers in the U.S., Africa, and around the world. Each month, you'll find real political analysis of the crisis of parasitic capitalism, insight into world and local events, and a focus on the realities and struggles in the heart of the hood, expressing the vision and voice of the African working class. Uncompromising truth, unwavering focus. The Burning Spear newspaper. This is Black Power in the 21st century. Subscribe today and don't get fooled again. Order your subscription now. Go to burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. That's burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. Uhuru.
You are listening to Uhuru Radio. And this is Diasporic Music. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalal. And joining me on the line is T.N. Providence, a playwright, radio producer, and an author. And T.N. Providence, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well. It's a little busy time, but, you know, part of the producing independent world.
Now, we're going to be talking about you as a playwright, you as a radio producer and an author, but we want to begin with you have a new play called The Session, and you wrote and put it together. And could you talk about what the play is about? Who are you working with, and when can the people in Toronto see it?
Okay, the play The Session is it's our debut production for a new theater company that we formed back in February this year. At the time, I was working with John Hospital and Melinda Francis, and right now I'm just working with her in the production team. The play, The Session, is about a young woman who finds herself with a very hard life, leaving home under some harsh circumstances, ending up on the street, falling into the way, and then seeing somebody who pretended or she believed was going to save her, and then at the end she discovered that she's betrayed by this person, and she commits an act that ends her up in prison. And the session is with her going through the psychiatric assessment, as to, you know, usually in most cases, in a lot of cases, they have you go through a psychiatric assessment to see if you can stand trial or something like that. So that's where the play takes place. She's in a psychiatrist's office, and she has to relive her life from the time she left home right up to the moment that she committed the crime. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I cut you off. Go ahead.
The woman who's the actor I'm working with is a young actor on the scene. Her name is Joella Crichton. She has worked with a few other theater companies. She's a graduate of York University theater program, and has done voice work at Stratford and different places. So, and then unfortunately, when I did the audition, I didn't really know who she was. And then when we started working together, discovered that she has connections to my home. Her parents are from the same country as I am, St. Vincent.
Mm-hmm. Now, the whole mental, this is basically dealing with mental illness. What inspired you to deal with the whole question of mental illness?
Well, the thing about it is that especially if you look around big cities, in a lot of big cities, you see people who end up on the street. And I remember asking myself questions like, why? What makes people, what makes people be? Like, there's some people are very successful. You may know friends who have become successful because of choices they've made or choices they didn't make. And you always wonder, I always believe that there's a reason why people do things. And writing this play, after I saw a video of George Michael's version of Roxanne, I started going, I'm like, yeah, why do people, why do some women become this person or that person, and why do some men become? So these were the questions that were asked me as I started writing this piece. And then Roxanne just grew out of that. It's the beginning of something, because I've been said it quite a lot that if you have a great foundation, you make a great life as you go along, right? And sometimes when you don't have that support at an early age, it could be disastrous. So this is one of the reasons why I wanted to write that. The state, her mind state, because of the circumstances of what she believes society has done, what a lot of things that people promise and then they just take them away, has gotten her to that point where she kind of loses her mind.
Well, don't you think that African people, be they on the continent, in the Caribbean, or in North America, or Europe, wherever we are, have really shied away from openly talking about mental illness? We don't deal with it. I mean, we deny it.
It is a situation where I find that we want to laugh a lot of things like that and pretend that it's not part of the family. I know in Toronto right now there is a situation where, police shooting, there's an investigation into, and there was, what also struck me that it was a young woman who had called the police to help her brother who was losing his mind. And we know the tragic circumstances, the brother was killed, he was shot by the police, right? And this is something that the community as a whole, asking people to thought, should try to talk a little bit more about mental illnesses, because it does affect us quite a lot, especially with the pressures of living within a society like the one we live in North America.
Right. Now, when and where is the play going to be? Because we wanted to move on to your radio show, Stage Left.
All right, the play is going to be at the Red Sandcastle Theatre, one of the smaller independent theatres who provide spaces for people like me who have to do plays with very little money at the beginning. So there's quite a few of these theatres in the city that are providing spaces. And this one is at 922 Queen Street East. And the play opens on next Wednesday, November 13th, and runs to Sunday the 17th.
Right. Now, you do several radio shows, but you have a theater show called Stage Left. And you were born in Kingstown, St. Vincent, not Kingston, Jamaica.
Not Kingston, no.
Yeah. But the thing about the It is my understanding that people from St. Vincent, some of the first, if not the first, theater groups in the United States were formed by people from your country. Is that true?
Right, that is quite true. There's a history of starting theaters way back in the early part of the last century in, you know, places like New York and those places. And one of the black African, Canadian, Caribbean persons who have been keeping our faces on television, Arden Best from St. Vincent. He's been in the game here in Toronto for quite a long time.
Okay, now stage left. What do you deal with on how you started stage left on the station? First of all, you're working for Radio Regent now, but you begin your radio career, I believe, at CKLN 88.1 in Toronto. Is that correct?
That is quite correct. The my first show on that was the Jazz Zone. And then I got into stage left when Don Mosley invited me. He was the former host. He invited me to become a part of it because he was looking for someone to help him out in that show. And I knew that I loved the theater. So I got involved with him, and he eventually left, and I continued producing it through many good years at CKLN. And now at CKLN, there was a half-hour show, which always felt kind of cramped. So there's a little good blessing that we moved to Radio Regent. I've gotten a full hour, and you could expand the shows. And we talk a lot about theater in Toronto, mainly the independent theater circuit, the people who, you know, who would benefit from earwave acknowledgement. And so it's been a great ride for the last, I think I've been doing it for 8 years now.
8 years.
Yes. Time does fly.
Mm-hmm. Now, can we talk about the Jazz Zone? You're from the Caribbean, and contrary to popular belief, the music that people know as jazz is loved by people around the world, including the Caribbean. Could you talk about that?
Well, yes, people from the Caribbean has always been in love jazz. In fact, if you look back at a lot of the early calypsos, I remember listening to a professor out of Barbados, Alombre Motley, who used to connect the links between the early calypso and the jazz. That was
Alombre Motley?
Yeah.
He's a legendary figure. I've heard of him since I've been in Canada. I've heard a lot about him.
Yes, he used to do a show on TBC Radio where he linked the connections, right? And then he listened to the early calypso. And then he used to tunes like what Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Jordan played calypso. You had Nat King Cole with his Calypso Girl. Duke Ellington was inspired by musicians from the Caribbean, jazz musician. In fact, he had a Cuban in his band. And yes. So there is, it has always been, and concerts, there have always been a lot of jazz concerts going down. And then during the period when I was growing up in the 70s, there was a lot of jazz musicians coming through the island because the America wanted to, you know, it was a lot of us knew it was a propaganda little thing, but they had a program that was run out of the Foreign Affairs Office of the Washington, I think it's called. And they had these musicians that had come around. So they do these tours throughout the Caribbean and Africa.
That was Voice of America you're talking about?
No, the Voice of America was a radio station that was that beamed music across. But these were actual musicians that came, that traveled. They were supported by the State Department. Louis Armstrong, all those guys went to Africa, and then they had other musicians coming to the Caribbean. And those guys. So jazz has been within the blood of the Caribbean folks for many, many, many years.
Well, you remember Jelly Roll Morton referred to, he talked about the Latin tinge. He talked about the impact that Cuban music had on the music of that we call... jazz. But now, could you talk about some of the Caribbean folks that made that impacted the jazz music? Like a lot of brothers and sisters went to England. Right? Could you talk about that?
Yeah, there were a lot of musicians, and one of the most prominent was Joe Harriet out of Jamaica. He, at the time, was developing the avant-garde style, independent of Ornette Coleman, but using the same ideas. One of his co-workers, co-musicians in that stream was Edward Shake Keen out of St. Vincent. In fact, in England, there is a festival, a jazz festival named after both of them, Joe Harriet, Shake Keen. There was a name. There was Don Drummond and those guys with the Scandalite that came out of Jamaica, went to England. And I remember picking up some albums with Herbie Mann playing with these guys. Melvin Moore, the great trombonist arranger. Melvin Liston.
Right.
Spent some time working in Jamaica, teaching and learning a lot. Eric Gale, who was a great guitarist during the 70s up to the 80s, him, Ralph McDonald, all these guys, powered music by Bob James, Grover Washington, these guys, they're all, Eric Gale's parents were from Barbados. He was conceived in Barbados, though, born in New York. Ralph McDonald moved over from Trinidad, and he spent a lot of time working with a lot of great musicians there. Of course, one of the great pan solos on a jazz album by Robert Greenidge on Grover Washington, just the two of us. So it's quite a lot of musicians that have made their impact around.
Now, you mentioned Ornette Coleman and Joe Harriet. Sort
right.
of developed separately, but they were doing similar things.
Right.
I guess the brother that you mentioned from St. Vincent, he would have sort of been like Don Cherry in terms of his relationship to Ornette Coleman.
Yes, he was the that kind of wingman whose ideas that it could pass between each other and really put it out, get the ideas down. So he was a great part. In fact, after Shake left England to go to Europe, Joe Harriet had a hard time finding people to really carry through his ideas that he really, really wanted to.
All right, let's move on to you as an author, Doc of the Bay, your book, Doc of the Bay. I guess, when people talk about the Doc of the Bay, they think about Otis Redding. But you're talking about the Doc of the Bay. You're talking about Kingstown, St. Vincent, I believe.
Yeah, it was based, loosely on the part of the Grenadines and St. Vincent, the mainland St. Vincent. So I kind of combined it into this land that I made up into that with this dock. It was a sort of adventure for a young boy who was learning what was happening while the play was written during the eruption of our Soufre Mountain. That was on the basis of it, that the Soufre Mountain was erupting, the volcano was erupting, so a lot of people had to leave their homes, and this young boy's mother was headed one of the evacuation camps and gave him a lot of time to roam and to expand because he had this view of, like, he wanted to be a great scientist and he wanted to learn a lot of things. And he met this older fisherman who kind of, gave him, was storytellers, like passing on one story to the other, filled his mind, and it's all the adventure of that. And most of it took place at this dock where this guy would fly these special kites he made. This kite flying was not a big thing as growing up in the Caribbean. We did a lot of kite flying.
Right. Now, St. Vincent and the Grenadines is the head of state now is a young man by the name of Ralph Gonzalez. But Ralph Gonzalez is leading the reparations movement now.
Yes.
They are suing, I think it's 13 countries, including Caribbean countries, and I think Suriname is part of it. They're suing Holland mm-hmm. and France and England. Yes, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it, I basically could understand that movement going on. I think a lot of it came out of the anger people felt after Haiti was destroyed by, you know, the hurricane, that earthquake that came through, and there was this whole big thing. And then it came to a lot of people at the time discovered, remembered, or was reawakened to the fact that the poverty that Haiti has been going through is all because mainly of how they were oppressed by a former colonial master, France, who actually had them pay back for earning their freedom. So there's quite a lot of this anger that was going through a lot of Caribbean people. I mean, reparation has always been a talk for many, 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 many years. In fact, the Calypsonians have sung about the idea of getting reparations. And so I think this is just a natural progression.
Right. Now, some of the people that came out of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, there was a young man by the name of Samori Marksman who was Vincentian, but he's longer in the land of the living. But he actually introduced me to Dr. Gerald Horn, and we brought him to Canada to speak one time. And Samori Marksman, the reason I'm bringing up Samori Marksman is that he used to be the point man for WBAI in New York City. And I remember he raised over $1 million for a Pacifica station, just before he passed away. Did you know Samori?
No, I didn't know him. I know his brothers, and they were a lot of the marksmen. They were a big family, and I knew a lot of his brothers. I did not know. In fact, you were the one who told me about Samori, and I did not really know him, but I knew his brothers.
Right, and the Vincentian. Who were some of the? Some of the Vincentians, there was I think a brother that used to be one of the captains of Marcus Garvey's ship, Mozak. Is it Mozak?
Mozak, yeah, Captain Mozak, who was one of the first. He became an officer in the U.S. Navy,
right.
One of the first black men to do that. In fact, there was when the first Coast Guard cutter boat that we had in St. Vincent when they were building up the Coast Guard defense, the ship was named after him, Captain Mozart.
Right. And I think his daughter had the Liberation Bookstore in Harlem, I believe.
Yes. There's quite a little bit of history. I know there is, I'm not sure if there's, I think there's a book out on him, but I haven't
read
it.
There is. I'm having a moment, but I've seen the book. I've never read it, but there is definitely a book out on him, and Gerald Horn talks about that, how people should read that book, right?
Yes, that's right. It's always good to read books about these people, how, because they did make a lot of things out of difficult circumstances to hold themselves together, you know what I mean?
We have about 3 minutes left. Is there anything else you would like to wrap up with?
Well, I just like people to come out and support, talk about support the show. I want to do things with this theater company, like, for instance, I know there's a lot of theater companies in Toronto right now trying to get ideas. People like Wilma Spencer with her Archipelago Productions, who did the story on Marcus Garvey a year and a half, 2 years ago, and so we are joining that force, and I think there's a lot of space for those stories. We just need our people to come out and support these stories, support the actors and the producers who are putting these out on stage. And I hope that they do for this one and for people like Obsidian and all those other groups that are still trying to get black stories onto stages.
All right. Those are your parting thoughts.
Yes. And thank you, Norman, for doing this. And thanks to the folks at Uhuru Radio.
All right. And thank you. And we have been speaking with T.N. Providence, a playwright, radio producer, and author. And thank you very much. And we are going to return to some great African music.
Bye for now.
All right. You're listening to the Uhuru Radio Network being broadcast and simulcast around the world, including on WMXP 95.5 FM in Greenville, South Carolina.
The Uhuru Movement invites you to the 6th Congress of the African People's Socialist Party, December 7th through 11th. 5 days, 3 locations, all in and around St. Petersburg, Florida. This is your chance to hear speakers from around the world, enjoy lectures, a grand banquet, and silent auction with African gifts from many countries. The African People's Socialist Party sprang to life in 1972 in an era of struggle for black power, for justice, and for self-determination. That struggle continues today and is even more urgent. Come and be a part of the largest gathering of freedom-loving African peoples and our allies. Turmoil and crisis reign across the globe. The system we were taught to believe in does not serve us. Colonized peoples on every continent are rising up to reclaim what is ours. The African People's Socialist Party is building a massive organization to unify African people worldwide. The goal being to regain control over the riches of Africa and the wealth that our labor has created. Here in America, where are we safe? In the gated communities? In the hood? In schools? For African people who thought we could make a future for our children inside the system, it's 50 years later, and Malcolm X's words ring truer than ever. The American dream, for us, is an American nightmare. Make plans now to join us for the 6th Congress of the African People's Socialist Party, December 7th through the 11th. 5 days, 3 locations, all in and around St. Petersburg, Florida. For more information, visit APSPUHURU.org. That's APSPUHURU.org. Or call 727-821-6620. That's 727-821-6620. This is your chance to learn more about you. Uhuru.
Habari Ghani, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great White North here in Toronto, Canada. And we have had a nice hour so far. Hopefully this next hour will be as strong as the first one. Maybe, I don't know, maybe you didn't think the first hour was strong. But everyone has an opinion. We would like to thank Clive Walker. Clive Walker has a book out called Dubwise, Reasoning from the Reggae Underground. And Clive Walker lives here in Toronto, and he helped me put this half an hour together dealing with the music of Don Drummond. And we're going to be speaking in a couple of weeks to Heather Augustine, and she has a new book out called Don Drummond, The Genius and Tragedy of the World's Greatest Trombonist, Don Drummond. And the foreword was written by trombonist Delfino Marsalis. That's one of the Marsalis brothers. He's a brother of Winton and Branford. And she spent 2 years researching and interviewing key people in Don Drummond's life, and she interviewed the former Prime Minister of Jamaica, P.J. Patterson, and he had a relationship with Don Drummond. But we're going to be playing some music from Don Drummond. And Don Drummond, the first piece, Don Drummond was with a group called the Scatolites, and the Scatolites were a ska band, and they were they did Jamaican jazz, really. And the first song we're going to play is called Fidel.
Mm-hmm.
are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great White North here in Toronto, Canada. And the mayor of Toronto, Rob Ford, is, I guess, making international news. Herb Boyd has heard about it, and there was actually a story in a German newspaper about the troubles of the current mayor of Toronto, Canada. But right now, we're paying tribute to Don Drummond, and there is a new book out called Don Drummond, The Genius and Tragedy of the World's Greatest Trombonist. And the foreword was written by Delfino Marcellus, who is the brother of, he's a trombonist, but he's the brother of Winton and Branford Marcellus, and he is talking about in 1985, he was in a taxi in New York, and a Jamaican cab driver told him that J.J. Johnson, a great trombonist from the United States, went to Jamaica just to hear Don Drummond, and his legend was so strong. That's what Delfino says, but he also says that he went home and he found his brother had some of the Scatellites' work with Don Drummond on it. And we're going to be listening to some great music from Don Drummond, and we're going to be playing a song called The Reburial. Now, The Reburial is about the reburial of Marcus Mosiah Garvey, because Marcus Garvey passed away in England, and his body was brought back to Kingston, Jamaica, and none other than Martin Luther King Jr. Spoke when at his reburial. He was King, wrote all of his books in Jamaica, if a lot of people don't know that, but King had a great relationship with Jamaica. So now we're going to be listening to Don Drummond and the Scatellites and The Reburial.
We'll be right back.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, and it's real cold. It's not really cold outside today, but trying to brace for this winter. But we are paying tribute to Don Drummond, and we are going to have Heather Augustine on Diasporic Music very, very shortly, and she did a great book out called Don Drummond, The Genius and Tragedy of the World's Greatest Trombonist. And Don Drummond was a key member in a group called the Scatolites. And I found out something that I didn't know. There is a great vocalist, or there was a great vocalist from Barbados, Jackie Opal. And he was one of the original lead singers of the Scatolites. And Jackie Opal hailed from Barbados. But we were listening to Marcus Jr. That's a song for Marcus Garvey's firstborn son. And we also heard another track called Addis Ababa, which is the capital of Ethiopia. And The Reburial was a song about Marcus Garvey, who was, he was buried in originally in London, and he was... his body was taken to Kingston, where he is buried right now. But the whole question of Don Drummond went to the so-called, quote-unquote, bad boy school in Jamaica called Alpha. And Alpha also, a lot of the great musicians went to, a lot of the Scatolites went to Alpha. And a young man by the name of Leroy Horsemouth Wallace, I remember. He's a great drummer, but I remember interviewing him. He went to Alpha. They had a great music program. Also, they had a so-called bad boy school in Detroit, and Levi Stubbs and the great late great Little Willie John went to, I think it was called Moores. I think they went to Moores, and it must be always mentioned that Barry White went to the so-called bad boy school in Los Angeles called Jacob A. Reese. And let us continue with our tribute to Don Drummond. We're going to be listening to Eastern Standard Time.
Thank you.
Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, in the cold white north. And it's not too bad outside today, but we are bracing ourselves for the winter. And we were listening to the music of, we're paying tribute to Don Drummond. A lot of this music was suggested to us by our brother Clive Walker, who was the author of Dubwise, Reasoning from the Reggae Underground. We suggest you go to Amazon.com or go to your local bookstore, preferably a black-owned and operated bookstore, and pick up a copy of Dubwise. But if you can't pick it up at a black bookstore, pick it up and get your information wherever you can. And we are going to be speaking with Miss Jody very, very shortly, but we continue with our tribute to Brother Don Drummond.
Thank you.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great white north here in Toronto, Canada. And we were paying tribute to Bobby Blue Bland, and Bobby Blue Bland was performing with B.B. King on the Soul Train show. And I just purchased a book, Soul of the Man, Bobby Bland by Charles Farley, and I'm definitely going to read that because I think I am probably Bobby Bland's biggest fan on earth. And joining me on the line from England is Marika Sherwood, who is a person that I've heard nothing but good things about. And Ms. Sherwood was born in Hungary, and
a very long time ago.
All right. With the remains of her Jewish family, she immigrated to Australia in 1948. She had a brief stint in New Guinea, where she was introduced to racism and colonialism. She returned to Sydney and attended university as a part-time student, and then immigrated to the quote-unquote mother country with her son in 1965. She was teaching in London schools, and she was it introduced her to many aspects of racism that were in the UK, and she basically has been in England for quite a while, and she wrote a great book called Malcolm X and His Travels Abroad, and she comes highly recommended from Abdul Al-Kaliman and also Abdul Mr. Razak in New York City. And I'm very honored to be interviewing Ms. Sherwood. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And well, thank you for all the flattery.
No, I've heard Abdul and Abdullah.
Mm-hmm.
Abdullah was Malcolm X's second in command.
Yes.
And, he speaks very highly of you. And I would like to tell you that he always talks about people. He's always being interviewed, and no one sends him a book. But he said, Marika Sherwood, she sent me a copy of a book. So you're in his good book.
Well, I couldn't have written the book without him. It's as simple as that.
Now, Mr. This book came out in what I brought it. First of all, I bought the book in Los Angeles, California, at Esalen Bookstore, and I understand you've been to Los Angeles.
Yes, yes, yes. I was invited there by Professor Bobby Hill, and gave some talks at the university and in some other places, which was absolutely wonderful. And let me tell you what was wonderful about it particularly, and I don't know if this is California or if it's the whole of the USA. I lived in New York from 1980 to 85.
5 years.
Yes. And it was very, very painful experience. Because of the level of racism for all my black colleagues, and then because it was totally unaccepted by at least some of my colleagues that this white woman should be writing about any aspect of the history of black peoples. I was writing about black peoples in Britain. And that caused some controversy, and that too was very, very painful. But when I was in California, there was nothing like that there. You know, it didn't seem to matter that my skin was white. People were listening to what I was saying and asking questions about what I had said. And none of it was focused on, well, what would this white woman understand? So maybe there's been a lot of change in the USA.
Well, when I was growing up in the U.S. of A., I grew up in Los Angeles, and for quite a while, I would have been on the saying, well, what is this white woman doing writing about Black mm-hmm. affairs, but I studied Malcolm, mm-hmm. and I don't think personally that biologically white folks are the devil, so I flip-flop my position because of Malcolm X, so mm-hmm. I can work with anybody that is has good politics, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I did quote Malcolm X and some of my exchanges in New York, but let me tell you a bit of my experience that I think gives me a sort of 1% sense of what it's like to be a black person in a racist society. As you said, I was growing up a little Jewish girl in Budapest, and I'd look like all other Hungarians. You couldn't tell me from anybody else. I was never noticed on the streets. But then you had to wear a yellow Star of David on your clothes every time you went out the door. So suddenly on the street, I was being name-called and spat at. I suppose, I don't know how many of those Hungarians really were Nazis, or if they just felt that they had to behave like that because of the number of police around.
Right.
But that, you know, that I kept remembering that when I was encountering racism and how horrific it was. And but I could take off the Star of David, and black people cannot change the color of their skin, nor should they, of course. But, you know, it perhaps gives me a different sense of understanding from people who haven't been through anything like that.
Right. But this Malcolm X book, mm-hmm. Malcolm X Visits Abroad, and I must admit that you went to Trace Malcolm's, well, he went to Africa, I guess the Middle East, as well as Europe, France.
Yes.
And England.
Yes.
And why, or how much time did it take for you to do the research to put this book together? And how many places did you have to visit?
Well, it took about 18 months to put it together. I must tell you that I never get research money in this country. In Britain, it's not accepted to be doing research on any aspect of the history of black peoples here, so there's never research money. So I couldn't follow in Malcolm's footsteps around Africa, which I think is what needs to be done.
Right.
So all I could do was read his travel notebooks, which were available at the Schomburg Center in New York, and then look at all the local newspapers in the British Library here in London. And, of course, here in England, talk with people who had met Malcolm when he was over here. So the book is not nearly as comprehensive as I would have liked it to be. Now, the reason I embarked on it is not just because people here in Britain didn't know that he had been here, you know, except for the people who had actually met him. It's written out of history. But because as I began to read his travel notebooks, I became more and more convinced that the American government had to have Malcolm obliterated, let's put it that way. I don't quite know what word one should be using. If you have somebody who is front page news around the world, like Malcolm was, talking about American dollarism, and warning not only the Organization of African Union, but also every country that he visited about the dangers of American dollarism. You can't let that man live. You can't let that man live. You know, he was talking about something so fundamental about what some people call neocolonialism. The dangers of dollarism are there today. Just look at the state of Africa. Malcolm couldn't be allowed to live, and he knew that. And the more I read his book and then followed up, the more painful it became and the more I admired him, because he knew he was going to be killed and he knew why he was going to be killed, because of what he was saying. But that didn't stop him saying what he wanted to say. Now that takes an enormous amount of courage when you know that sooner or later they will manage to kill you.
Could I interrupt you here? I remember reading Manny Marable's book, and I was very upset at one of the things he said, that Malcolm was so worried, which he was, that he drank the rum and coke in Ghana, and he didn't say, it was good or bad, didn't make a judgment on it, but the whole thing, I guess if you're under that pressure, so if he drank a rum and coke, so what? That was my attitude. And I understand you were involved in that Manning Marable project, but you were kind of shut out, or is that true?
Yes, I had known, I met Marable when I was living in New York. I admired him. He was left-wing, and I am left-wing. I must be very honest about that. I'm proud of it, too. I'm against capitalism. So I admired Marable, but then he came to Columbia in New York, and his politics seemed to change. Anyway, he had heard that I was researching Malcolm, so on one of my visits to New York, he said, would I come and speak to his students, which I did. Would I mind being filmed by his research assistants about what my concerns were? I said, no, I don't mind. So I was. And what I expected Marable to do, because he had lots of research money, was to do what I asked. Go and follow in Malcolm's footsteps around Africa. Find all the people he met. Interview them all. Look at all the newspapers that we don't have access to, either in the Library of Congress or here at the British Library. And Manning did nothing like that. And I think he totally misrepresents Malcolm. I think, to me, the book is absolutely appalling. Absolutely appalling.
Well, we've had a lot of discussions on Uhuru Radio and on my show, Diasporic Music, about the book, and many people, I guess it was very, 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 very controversial. There were a few people that supported him, but I think, I don't know if he won a Nobel. He won many prizes and, got New York Times to reprinted it, but it looked like the African Liberation Movement, most people rejected it. But I wanted to ask you about what role did Jan Carew play? Because Jan Carew was a very good friend of mine, and Jan is no longer in the land of the living. I guess I can say this now. But Jan helped many of us who refused to go to Vietnam. I mean, he was a 20th century Underground Railroad man. And what role did Mr. Carew, who was born in Guyana, play in this book?
Listen, he really didn't. I also knew Jan. I met him here in London. But no, he didn't play any role in this book. Because I would have, he just didn't let me put it that way. There's no negative reasons for it at all.
Right.
To talk about Malcolm, you have to be face to face, and we just couldn't be face to face. I told you I don't get any money for research, so traveling around is very difficult. It's very difficult.
Why can't you get money? Because you're not a PhD, or you're not tied to a university. What is the issue?
No, the issue is that that this country does not want to admit that it had a population of African origins or descent until 1948.
Mm-hmm.
In in fact, Africans have lived here since they first arrived as a regiment within the Roman army. And we now know that it wasn't just a regiment, because not very long ago, a grave was dug up north of London of a woman of African origins with a lot of jewelry. So she's clearly a very wealthy woman. We don't yet know who on earth she was, but, you know, clearly there was an African woman who was also wealthy. So I doubt if she was the only one.
All right.
Now, the governments here, and it doesn't matter whether it's Labour or Conservative, they simply don't want to admit that we have had a black population for 2,000 years.
So it's just like the Democrats and Republicans in the United States. They're both two capitalist parties.
Yep. And you just cannot have that. Now, I would love to have a DNA survey done of British people from Scotland down to Cornwall just to see how many DNAs show some level of African descent. You know, I can't guess how many it would be.
Right.
But we certainly had Africans here, and there is now some research, very little, on Africans here in the Renaissance period and in the Tudor period, so 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries. But we have no courses except for two in the whole country on this history, because they don't want it taught and they don't want it researched. I have been trying to set up a taught master's course, because there would be lots of students who would take a taught master's course. And all the universities I approach say, oh, yes, yes, well, it would be very interesting, but sorry, there's just no money for anything like that. You know, and then I say, well, given the fees that we now charge for university courses, you don't need any money. There'd be enough students to pay for the lectures. Oh, no. You know, it's just not history they want to know. So it wouldn't matter whether I had six PhDs or none. I don't have one, but I have, I think, seven books in print. you know, it's not to do with that. It's to do with this isn't our history.
Right. I wanted to ask, had you finished? I'm sorry for cutting you off.
Sorry?
I said I'm sorry for cutting you off. Had you finished?
No, that's all right.
Abdullah Razak, Malcolm... Mm-hmm. He was Malcolm's second in command, and he spent 13, 14, maybe 13 years in Guyana.
Mm-hmm.
And he was born in New York. I think his father was born in Virginia, and his father was a member of the Communist Party in the United States, but Abdullah is Muslim, and how much did he help you?
Oh, enormously. I mean, not only did he give me information, but he encouraged me to go on to do the work, because, you know, I was unsure, not only because I didn't have the money, but, you know, I am a Hungarian. I lived only for 5 years in New York. So even the most superficial understanding is, you know, I wasn't sure I had it. But no, he was wonderful. After our conversations, he just said, no, go ahead, right, you know. And if you need to know any more, just come back to me. I'll tell you what I know. So support like that is absolutely crucial when you're very uncertain if you can do justice to what you are researching, never mind justice to Malcolm, which, you know, of course, I mean, that's a joke, you know. No way can I achieve that. But I hope that I have opened the door for some people to really look at the last year of Malcolm's life, which he spent mainly abroad, And he spent it not only talking about dollarism and neocolonialism and the racism in this country, but also meeting many politically active people wherever he went. Mainly, and I could be quite wrong, I told you I wasn't able to follow his footsteps, but certainly the people I know he met were all what we would call left-wing people, by which I mean that they were talking about the necessity for socialism, for equality, and of course to do away with colonialism and the racialism that was suffusing the whole world. So looking at what Malcolm did in the last year of his life, I think is very, very important to all of us who see ourselves as part of this struggle and want to understand the history of the struggle.
I'm speaking with Marika Sherwood, and I was influenced by El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X, and my generation. We had to choose whether or not we were going to follow the Nation of Islam or whether or not we were going to follow El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X. And I basically wanted to put on the record right now that Mr. Muhammad, I have nothing but respect for Mr. Muhammad, but I disagree with him politically. I supported Malcolm X's ideas, and I think that if you check out the record, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in Detroit, the Revolutionary Action Movement, SNCC, the Black Panthers, of course, those people supported the secular side of Malcolm because Malcolm was a Muslim, but he basically said to put your politics first, and if your religion wasn't doing anything for you, you know, to put it in a closet, you need to get away with it, throw it away anyway. And, you know, other people supported, like Imam Amil Alameen, Jamil Alameen, pardon me, you know, they supported, became Sunni Muslims, but the whole question of socialism, I agree with you because Malcolm basically pointed us in that direction.
Yes, he wanted very much for us all to go in that direction. And I mean, I don't know that much about Islam, but I don't think Islam would be against socialism. You know, we don't look at the very sad conflict between Sunni and the Shia now, and you know, we need to sort of dig beneath the wall to see who is manipulating whom in that. But what I have read about Muhammad, and I have read his life story, and I have read about Islam, I don't think Islam is against socialism at all.
I don't either, because Thomas Sankara from Burkina Faso made the statement that, you know, if he was on an island, he would want three books. He would want the Bible, he would want a Quran, and he would want a copy of State and Revolution by Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. And he said that, you know, in this period of history, that Lenin was the most concrete example of what was happening today, but Islam had some, you know, some principles, egalitarian principles, as well as, you know, Jesus did chase the money chasers out of the, you know, Jesus was not a capitalist.
No, he certainly wasn't. I think Jesus was a great revolutionary. I don't think many in the Christian churches would appreciate me saying that, but I think he was.
We are really running out of time, and I definitely want to bring you back and continue this discussion. We have a few more minutes left. But I basically wanted to go on record to tell everyone to pick up a copy of Malcolm X Visits Abroad by Marika Sherwood, who published the book. It's a Los Angeles, it's a American publisher, right?
Yes, yes. In America, it's an American publisher. It's called Sahai Publishers in California.
And how did you get a hold of them?
Well, we met when I was in California before the meeting we talked about. And
with Professor Bobby Hill.
Yeah, and Elias and I talked, and he said, well, I'd be very happy to publish it. So I was delighted.
Did you ever go to the Esalen bookstore in Los Angeles?
No, I don't remember.
Okay, yeah.
I don't remember the names of the bookstores I went to, but, you know, I went to where various colleagues directed me to go.
Right. I mean, I thought you might have had a book. I bought the book from Esalen bookstore, which was James Fugate, and runs the Esalen bookstore, and he's had everybody in that bookstore from you to Bill Clinton to Barack Hussein Obama and so on and so forth. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Because we're going to have to get off of this phone, and definitely, like, I definitely want to invite you back.
No, not about Malcolm, except perhaps to say that we all owe him a lot. And please read the book, because what he was doing in that last year of his life is very, very important and very relevant to the world today. Very relevant to the world today.
And one last thing, your latest book, could you talk about it for 2 seconds?
The latest book is very different. It's on World War II and the contributions of colonies and colonials and what the British government was doing in the colonies, which was jailing a lot of people. And I wrote that because we all talk about World War II and we completely ignore the 650,000 Africans who fought for Britain and the 2.5 million Indians who fought for Britain, and we ignore the appallingly recruited and badly paid workers who produced the metals so that Britain could build aeroplanes, you know, so that people here could eat. And that also is just wiped out of history in this country. So I thought, well, let me put it together, you know, so we can recognize that, in my mind, Britain could not have won the war without America, of course, but also without the colonial contributions.
All right, Ms. Sherwood, I thank you very much, and we will talk to you a little bit later. And thank everyone for listening. I'd like to thank Lisa Watkins for her technical brilliance today, and we will see you in the whirlwind. Take care.
Thank you very much indeed, everybody. Bye.
Bye-bye.